You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. Beautiful day in Iowa. Fantastic day. I understand it's snowing greatly in out west, but I don't care. I don't ski, so I don't care.
It doesn't get much better than this.
No, it doesn't.
May and October are the two months that we really, if we had a few more months like that, we'd be very crowded here in Iowa.
True.
Because everybody would want to be here.
Right.
And there's lots of nice, fun things going on around Fairfield this weekend.
Okay. Last weekend was great.
Oh, yeah.
Oktoberfest Art Walk was fantastic.
Yeah, we went and heard Mary Swander, who had been our guest a couple of weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, yeah.
And she had a reading and book signing at 21st Century Bookstore.
Yeah.
She was wonderful. And this weekend, what are some of the things? Oh, there's the new local movie, Sister Patchouli, is playing at the Civic Center tonight. Tomorrow night at the Civic Center is the Maya Quartet, which I believe is a string quartet. And the farmer's market is still very active in the park.
On Saturdays.
Saturday mornings, yep. And just for a heads up on something happening in just a little bit from now, this afternoon at 4 p.m. on Planet Earthwild, James Moore will be interviewing Naomi Wolf, author of the New York Times bestseller The End of America and The Beauty Myth. And her new book is called Give Me Liberty, A Handbook for American Revolutionaries. In it, she illustrates how ordinary citizens engaging in the democratic process can accomplish extraordinary things.
Well, that should be very interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, we have a very interesting guest today,
too. And I say this every week. This is a great book.
True.
It really is. It's one of those you can't put down books. Because the action moves, and it's just, you know, and you remember that TV program, You Are There? Well, that's the kind of book this is, You Are There.
Mm.
Really.
The title of this book is Beside a Burning Sea, and the author is John Shores. Welcome to Writer's Voices, John.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, John, tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to write this book, which is a story set during World War II.
Sure. Well, I'm an Iowa boy. I was raised and for many years lived in Des Moines.
Oh, I did not know
good.
That.
Good for you.
Absolutely. I was just back there a couple of weeks ago, in fact. It's always fun to get back to Iowa. I grew up in Des Moines and spent some summers up at Okoboji and doing all that. And I love Iowa. I have very fond memories and try to get back a couple times a year. And essentially, in terms of how I got to be a writer, I went to school out in Colorado at a small school called Colorado College and studied fiction there and so forth. But really, the answer to the question is very simple. I've got three younger brothers, and when we were all probably 10, 11, 12, 13, my father threw away our television. So we all grew up reading, and I've read a couple of books a week my whole life, and it's just something that I've wanted to do for a long time in terms of trying to be a novelist. It's not an easy thing to break into, but now it's going quite well.
What were you doing while you were trying to break in as a novelist?
Well, I lived overseas for a couple of years. After graduating, I wanted to experience the world, and I went over to Japan, where I was an English teacher, and I did that for a couple of years, and then I traveled all over Asia, and then I came back to actually Des Moines, and became a newspaper reporter for the business weekly there called the Des Moines Business Record. And I did that for a couple of years, and I learned a lot about writing. I had a great editor. And then I moved out to Colorado with my new wife and started a public relations agency and did that for about 5 years while I was writing my first novel, Beneath the Marble Sky. And I would work all day at the PR agency, and then at night I would work on my novel. And this took about 5 years, and that came out a couple of years ago, and it's done quite well, so now I'm a full-time novelist and have achieved that kind of lifelong dream.
Great. So you have another novel in the works?
I do. So my third one, which is actually set in modern-day Saigon, is I'm almost done with it. It's due December 15th to Penguin, my publisher. So I've got a couple of more months to edit and clean it up a little bit, and then I will send it out, and it'll come out the following September.
Wow.
Well, let's start with Beneath a Marble Sky. Where's that book set?
Well, I was in India, and I was traveling around India, and I was at the Taj Mahal, and I saw the Taj Mahal, and I was so entranced by it. And I heard about the wonderful story behind its creation, that the emperor built it in memory of his wife, and as she lay dying after delivering her 14th child, she asked her husband to grant her one wish, and that one wish was to build her something beautiful, and then go to her tomb on their anniversary and light a candle. And this was her one wish, and he certainly took it to the 10th degree. I mean, he spent the rest of his life seeing that the Taj Mahal was completed. Mm. And it's just a beautiful story. And there's a lot more that's going on with this royal family than that. In history, there were a couple of brothers who from this family that had a civil war against each other, and the emperor ends up in prison with his daughter, and all sorts of crazy stuff happens. And as I was researching this era in the Taj Mahal, I was very struck by the fact that no novelist had ever written a story on the Taj Mahal before. I mean, you have this wonderful, world-famous building and this incredible story behind its creation, and no one had ever written a novel about it. So I felt like there was an opportunity here to bring that story to life.
I would say you were led to write that, wouldn't you?
I was. I really was. And I feel very, very blessed. And I've been contacted by scores and scores of other novelists who have said, wow, I wish I'd had that idea before you.
Whose point of view did you write that story from?
It's told, it's in the first person, so my narrator is the princess, the daughter of Shah Jahan and his wife Arjamand. And it's really, she was the one person that could speak to all of the big events in the book. She could talk about her parents' love affair. She could talk about the rise of the Taj Mahal, because she was actually at her father's request, she was the assistant to the architect.
Mm.
As soon as the Taj Mahal was finished, there was this brutal civil war between her brothers, and she actually supported the brother who ended up losing the war. And then she was imprisoned with her father in this giant fortress for 8 years, where they could look out through this one window and see the Taj Mahal.
Oh.
So all the big historical events that I wanted to touch upon, she was the one character that could bring those to life. And it's funny, you know, for me as a guy from Des Moines, to try to bring the voice of a 17th century Indian princess to life wasn't the easiest thing in the world, but I think she's a really good character, and people really seem to identify and connect with her. And it's been fun, and I enjoy telling the book from her perspective.
This was a true story, all this.
It is, yeah. It's historical fiction, so I took a couple of liberties, but 80% of the book is really parallels what happened in real life.
So how did you find out all that? Do they have records there? They have this in some kind of...
They do. I spent a month in India, which certainly helped. And then I came back and I researched everything that I could about the Taj Mahal. I spoke to experts in India. I studied the different religions. I read the Quran cover to cover and the Hindu texts. And I looked at hundreds and hundreds of paintings from the period that very richly detailed life in the harem, or a battle scene, or wedding ceremony, or polo match. And through all this, I was able to bring that period, that culture, those people to life. But I spent about 5 years working on the book, so
I'm amazed. I'm amazed you were able to get it done in 5 years.
I am too.
It was tough. I mean, I was very diligent about it, and I would come home from work from my public relations job and have dinner, and then work on my novel from 7 to 10 every night, and on weekends and on vacations. And I was just very committed to bringing this story to life. And
how did your family do with you being, working all day and then coming home and working all night?
Fortunately, I did most of it before my wife and I had kids. And my wife was very accommodating in terms of my writing. And I was really kind of probably halfway done with my novel when our first child was born. So that helped. And so they're understanding, and they know that to break into publishing, you have to make some sacrifices. That's just the nature of the game. And I've always been very, honest to my wife about this, the dream of mine and what it's going to entail. And without question, it's been a tough road. It's just a really hard business to break into. But now, Beneath Marble Sky, it's in 20 different languages. It's a bestseller in a couple of different countries. We sold the movie rights to Hollywood, and everything's going quite well, so it's all worked out.
Now, you did something rather unusual to promote Beneath the Marble Sky.
I did. I felt like I wanted to give something back to readers. I felt like if readers were going to go out and buy my novel and support me, tell their friends about it, spread the word, that I wanted to be supportive back. And so what I did, and this had never been done before, I put my a letter to the readers in the back of my paperback that invited book clubs to invite me to their evenings via speakerphone, and I included my email address. And the program had never been done before. We really didn't know what to expect. And I launched it in the summer of 06, and it started to get some media attention. So the Denver Post did a story on it, National Public Radio did a story on it, Newsweek magazine then picked it up, and then I had a call from the CBS Evening News, and they wanted to do a feature piece on it. And so they did the feature piece, and the next day I had 800 emails in my inbox.
I'll bet.
All over North America. So over the last 14 months, I've spoken to about 1,300 book clubs all over the place, from Zambia to South America to Paris, and of course all over the U.S. and Canada. And it's been great for my novel. It's made my novel a bestseller, so it's certainly worked out for me, and yeah. I think book clubs have enjoyed it, too.
Well, I'm sure they have.
But how in the world do you have time to do that and still and write beside a burning sea? How did you
it's
put
hard.
That in?
It's tough. I will write at night. Basically, what I do is I'll wake up, and I'll work from 9 to 3 on my novel, and then I will answer. I usually get a couple hundred emails from readers who aren't book clubs but just have questions or want to compliment me on the book or whatever. So I answer all those, and I'll quit at perhaps 5 o'clock and go goof around with my children for a couple of hours, have dinner, and then I'll start making my phone calls to book clubs. And I usually will start on the East Coast and then work my way to the West and do 4 or 5 calls a night. And, I like connecting with book clubs. It's funny. I never know what kind of club I'm going to talk to. Some of them are very studious and have been researching the Taj Mahal and come prepared with a lot of questions, and other groups have been drinking margaritas for 3 hours. For sure what kind of group I'm going to get, but I enjoy them all.
Now, do you get asked the same questions over and over again?
People do. There are certain questions that I always get asked. For instance, people are curious about what was fact and what's fiction in the book, and why I chose Jahanara as my narrator, and there are questions like that that I inevitably get. And then there usually is a question or two that I haven't heard before that stumps me for a few seconds. And so I'm continuously impressed with the insights of all these readers, and that's been really fun for me.
And how long do you spend with each book club?
About 15 minutes.
Wow.
I would like to spend more time, but doing so many calls is impossible to do more than that. And so we have, and I find that that's enough. I mean, readers can ask me, maybe 8 to 10 questions, and we get the good questions, we talk them through and have a nice little visit, and then I move on to the next call, and it seems to work really well.
This is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is John Shores, author of Beneath a Marble Sky and his latest book, Beside a Burning Sea. And then he's got another one that will be coming out next spring?
Next September.
September, okay. And have any authors followed in your footsteps about offering to connect with
They have, yeah. And it's funny. Some of them will email me and say, how do I do this, John? How do I set this up? And I'm very accommodating because I think there's a need for it, and I want other authors to do it. I think it's good for the publishing industry. I think there needs to be a writer-reader connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if more authors were doing that sort of thing, perhaps book sales wouldn't be so flat. So I really try to be accommodating. Publishers Weekly, the big trade magazine, has done a couple of stories on my program where I really try to kind of outline to other writers how to do this. And it's funny, I'm definitely aware of a lot of other authors doing this now. I'll go to a website for some reason, and I'll see the author is promoting this book club program. It's kind of a mirror of what I've done. And I'm happy that it's going on. I think it's great, because I believe that there's a real need for it.
Well, plus they say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Yeah. I mean, it's great that they're doing it. There's a tremendous need, and anything that can be done to get readers excited to read and get more people involved in reading, that's a good thing for the industry. It's a good thing for me. So I'm happy if other readers are doing it.
You said that you had sold the movie rights to that one about the Taj Mahal, and I was thinking that this one, Beside a Burning Sea, would make a good movie too.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's exciting for my second one, Beside a Burning Sea, which is a classic love story set in the South Pacific at the height of World War II. It just came out a few weeks ago, and we've got my agent has got some film people very interested in it, and my first novel, Beneath the Marble Sky, the story of the Taj Mahal. I don't know if you ever watched the television show ER, but if you did, you might remember Dr. Benton. His name is Eric LaSalle, and Eric read book and just hopped on a plane and flew to India. And when he got back, his production company bought the film rights. So they've got a big-time screenwriter involved, a big-time director, and they've almost got the script done. And once that's completed, they will go out and start raising quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
It's not just a walk in the park. It takes a little while, but it's going quite well, and that's certainly fun for me.
Well, it's interesting because selling the rights to a book to Hollywood and having a movie actually made, there's a huge gap between those two. Many, many more books are sold than actually get made into movies.
Is that right?
And it's certainly possible that that will happen to me, that the book will never get made into a movie, but it's interesting. I mean, they have to, in all honesty, pay us every year to retain the film rights. And so if it takes them 20 years, that's okay with me.
Well, it sounds like they're really making progress, because I think
They are. They are making some excellent progress, despite the writer's strike and things like that. I mean, I'm a little worried about all this economic disaster and how that's going to affect their ability to go out and raise a lot of money. So I'm definitely, I'll be interested to see how that plays out. But they seem to be making good progress.
Well, one possibility on that is that there's a lot of people sitting on a lot of cash.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
And they're gonna want to do something with it at some point. So
yeah, that's true.
It may actually
that'll come to bear.
Yeah, it may actually help this type of venture. Now, you made the same offer to book clubs with Beside a Burning Sea? Have you been getting a similar response from readers?
I have. You know, for Beneath the Marble Sky, when I first launched the program, there was a little bit of a lag time between when the paperback came out and when the book club started contacting me. And the same thing's happening with Beside a Burning Sea. It's only been out a month. So I think, you know, what happens is typically somebody will get the book, read it, and then see my offer, and then talk to her book club members about it. So it takes 5 or 6 weeks for that to all kind of percolate before they contact me. Mm-hmm. So I'm just starting to get a lot of emails about Beside a Burning Sea, and it's in that regard, it really follows what happened with my first novel, Beneath the Marble Sky.
Now, I'm assuming you kept the contact information of all the book clubs that you spoke to your first book about. Did you send them information about your second book?
I did. It's the only time I emailed them. I let them know when but it's funny, I've had other authors offer me. You know, a month ago I had an offer tell me he'd give me $5,000 for my list of book clubs, but I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to have you. But it is a nice list, and it's probably the largest, one of the largest collection of book club lists around. And so I definitely let them all know about my new book and how that was evolving, and certainly let them know where to get it and all that stuff.
Right.
So hopefully they went out and bought it.
Now, do you like talking to the authors of books that you've read?
I do. But my experience was, aside from book signings, that was kind of a hard thing to do. And that's one of the reasons that I came up with this book club idea, to make it very easy for readers to talk to me. I just wanted to make it as easy as possible, and that's why I put my email address in the back of the book and so forth. I've certainly met some wonderful authors at book signings, but I don't know, my experience with book signings is that you've got, you know, 50 strangers in a room together, and it's just, they're great and they're important, but they're not that intimate of a setting. And I think that having a book club that's been together for 20 years, talking to an author on the phone, they get a little bit more involved and I think have more fun, perhaps, than a book signing and so forth. So I think it's been great for all these clubs.
Caroline, have you ever been in a book club?
No, I never have.
I haven't either. I've had friends who have been in ones, and I've always been kind of...
I've been tempted, but I've never been in one.
Yeah, I've never...
Maybe the two of you need to start one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, something else to do.
We could start an on-air book club, kind of like Oprah's.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we could.
Yeah, we could do the Writer's Voices book club.
We could. Okay. Well,
that would be
this
fun.
Is our first one.
Yeah. So, Beside a Burning Sea, how did the concept for this story originate? And why did you decide to write this book next?
Well, I had spent about 3 years in Japan, and I was always kind of intrigued with why America was at war with Japan in the Pacific, why that happened, how it played out. And I was kind of just, I've always been fascinated by that period. And then I heard the story of a U.S. hospital ship called the U.S. Mercy. It was out patrolling in the South Pacific, and these hospital ships would basically go into the aftermath of these giant battles, and they would pick up wounded soldiers, whether they be American or Japanese or whomever. International law mandated that they pick up anybody they see. So these hospital ships would be filled with Americans and Japanese, and one of them, the U.S. Mercy, was actually attacked by a kamikaze plane. And it killed quite a few nurses and doctors and patients and so forth. So I was kind of intrigued with the idea of trying to write a classic love story set in the South Pacific. And I thought it might be neat to have this American nurse who falls in love with a Japanese patient who, although he's a Japanese soldier, he's forced into the war, and he's a wonderful man who's a former professor and poet and so forth. So they have this unlikely love story, and their ship gets attacked and so forth. And the Japanese is kind of forced to really trust some Americans and vice versa. And I thought it would be kind of an interesting spin on that war, and to show some different perspectives of the war. And so I spent about a year working on it, and as I say, it just came out, and the reviews have been quite good, and people seem excited about it.
Well, I really enjoyed it, and it is a tearjerker in places. I cried. One place.
I didn't hear that. That was my intent.
Yeah. Because your characters are very vivid. And this, you know, and the boy, Ratu, and Jake, their relationship was just beautifully illustrated, I thought.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your compliments. And I certainly like to try to have different voices in my novels and different characters and kind of unusual voices. And I have fun creating those people. So I'm glad that you connected with the characters.
Now, you said that your first book was written in first person,
mm-hmm.
But this one is third person.
Yeah, I just felt like Beneath the Marble Sky, it had to be, I just felt like the story had to be told by someone. And I thought, who better than to tell it than the daughter of the emperor and empress? And in terms of Beside a Burning Sea, I didn't want to fall into any sort of particular pattern. But like, it would have to be a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it's told in the third person I think there are 9 different characters in the book. And there are, I think, 6 main characters.
And you shift point of view character during the book?
I do. I bounce from person to person. And there's some subplots and so forth. And then there's some characters that are certainly more important than others. But it was a nice change of pace for me, and at some point I'll probably go back to first person, but I don't want to be doing the same thing over and over again, so it was fun to mix things up a bit with that.
Well, as a writer, I find that the decision about point of view in a story is really one of the most crucial decisions that you make, and I've had some problems myself with, you know, using a third-person shifting point of view. You can lose the reader sometimes if you're not shifting at the right times, I guess. So how did you, were you thinking about that as you wrote?
You know, in all honesty, that's there are plenty of things I worry about.
That isn't one of them.
About the same thing, but I would almost position it as pacing. I mean, I want the novel to keep moving. So I sometimes shift the point of view to do that very thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I mean, I think sometimes readers can get lost in the transition. But I like to change things up a little bit and to keep it kind of fresh. And you're right. I mean, every book will have better characters than others, and you obviously want to focus on those better characters. But I don't mind shifting things up and going to a different point of view, as long as that point of view has a compelling subplot and the reader's interested in that. You certainly don't want to turn away from your bread and butter story to have some boring subplot. And there's certainly, I think there are some wonderful books, quite frankly, where I felt kind of lost in the subplot. I mean, I remember reading Lonesome Dove, which is one of my all-time favorite books, and the central characters are so compelling, but every once in a while, Larry McMurtry would shift to these characters I thought were much weaker, and I was always kind of a bit missed by that. I certainly understand what you're talking about, and I think a writer has to be aware of that.
Yeah, I didn't notice any jarring shifts.
No, I didn't either.
In your book, it was very smooth. I know, like, having some of my own work workshopped before, that it's been pointed out that it's usually not a good idea to change point of view in the middle of a scene, that you complete the scene before shifting. Usually, and I don't know, I don't know if you did that or not, because I didn't notice it. So if I didn't notice it, then it means you probably did it.
It's funny. There's people say there's so many rules in writing. You can't shift in the middle of the scene. You can't, God forbid, you'd ever use an adverb. Really hung up on these various rules. And my point is I don't think that there are rules in writing. I think if it works, if it moves the story forward and it connects with your reader, do whatever you want to do. And I think you're right. For the beginning of the story especially, I would never transition away from a scene. I would want a certain amount of closure before I went to a different point of view. But you'll note at the end of Beside a Burning Sea, when the action really gets moving fast, things are really flying, then I shift. Like, my scenes will only be a page and a half long, and I'm going back and forth between different characters, and I'm leaving all these little cliffhangers. So from that perspective, I'm totally leaving the scene halfway through it. And that's very intentional, because I think you can build up pace that way and keep the reader really turning the pages.
Of course, your timeline, day one, day two on this island, made it good, because day one, and then when day one is over, then we're going on to day two. And what did they do in day two, and how did they act? And
It gave a very coherent structure to the story. When did you make that decision to structure it that way?
I think I made that decision when I decided to start every chapter out with a haiku that's written from the perspective of the Japanese soldier, because he's a former poet, and he's teaching this nurse, this American nurse, about Japanese haikus and so forth, and encouraging her to come up with her own and all this. And I thought it'd be neat to start out every day with a haiku from Akira's perspective. And I thought, well, if I do that, I need to break each chapter up into a single day. And so I came up with the concept of having the day 1 through day 18, and having 18 different haikus. And it's funny, because my first novel, Beneath a Marble Sky, takes place over probably 50 years. And my second novel takes place over 18 days.
Yeah.
Obviously a very different timeline there. But I have fun with both of those.
Of course, the action is moving because they have the battle, the sea battle that they witness, and the air battle that they witness, and they're in the middle of this war, even though they're on a deserted island. They're in the middle of it, and that
a paradox. They're in this tropical paradise, but there's this war unfolding around them, and that's why for those of you that have seen the cover of the book, I think it makes a lot of sense, because you're looking out from this beautiful island, and there's this kind of battleship looming in the distance, and it's this kind of dichotomy that is at work there, being this tropical paradise and perhaps falling in love, and meanwhile there are these ships going up in flames in the distance. And I think a lot of that happened in World War II.
I'm sure it did. Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is John Shores, author of Beside a Burning Sea.
Okay, now I want to ask him this. This is in the Solomon Islands. Takes place in
right,
Solomon Islands.
Yes.
Okay, did you have to research what happened between Japan and the United States in that in those islands?
Definitely, I did. I spent a couple years in Japan, which helped. I spent 6 months in the South Pacific, which helped. And then I just got out plenty of books and really got to understand why those islands were so important. And essentially after Midway, when we defeated the Japanese fleet and sunk, I think, four of their, like, six aircraft carriers, the Japanese really had to establish air bases on these little islands,
mm-hmm.
or else the war is essentially over because all their aircraft carriers have been sunk. And by establishing bases in places like the Solomon Islands, the Japanese would have been able to attack places like Australia and so forth. You know, they really wanted to invade Australia. And so there was a real focal point, and the U.S. Navy knew that they couldn't allow the Japanese to establish these powerful bases on these uninhabited islands. And so we had these bloody, bloody battles on some of these islands, island to island, to keep the Japanese from establishing these air bases. And so I have the sight of Burning Sea take place on one of these islands. That's a beautiful island, but it's flat. It's got a great harbor. And the people that are on this island know that at some point the Japanese or the Americans are going to come in and try to establish an air base, and that there's probably going to be some sort of battle on the island.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you were living in Japan and in the South Pacific, were you thinking that you were someday going to write a book that was set there?
Well, I was intrigued with that possibility, and I felt like I understood the Japanese mind well, so I wanted to have a Japanese character. I was going to have my first novel actually take place in Kyoto, the ancient capital of Japan, but then Arthur Golden came out with Memoirs of a Geisha, and I didn't want to play copycat, so I shifted my focus and decided to do the Taj Mahal novel, and that was very successful, and then I kind of went back to doing something with Japan. And again, I was intrigued with the notion of these hospital ships and how they put people together on different sides of the war, and was really excited to try to bring a kind of a classic.
You know, it's very interesting because just coincidentally, our guest next week is Jerry Yellen, who has just written a fictionalized account of a story set in Japan, World War II, where two American B-29 bombers crashed above the city, and it was during a firebomb of this town that killed 2,000 citizens, but 23 American soldiers died there too. And a doctor in that town began actually buried the Americans and started celebrating Memorial every year for them as well as the citizens of his own town. And
that's unusual.
Yeah. It's quite unusual, and mm-hmm. it's really an interesting story. And it's, like I said, it's just coincidence that his book was just released last week, and he asked to be on our show next week.
Hopefully, our books will help each other out.
Yeah, and what's also interesting is our guest last week was Robert McDowell, author of Poetry as a Spiritual Practice, and he has a whole chapter on haiku. In his book, and that was published by Simon & Schuster, I believe.
It's a very interesting book.
Yeah, yeah. And so we told him about your book, too, with the haiku in it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Because they're a neat art form. I mean, I think, and it's fun. I've had many, many readers, after reading Beside a Burning Sea, it's interesting that will send me haikus they've written. Say, what do you think, John? So it's kind of fun to get emails from people who I think have had a lot of fun with trying to write haikus and so forth.
I think we all remember, or at least I remember, as a child in school.
Yeah, there was always a unit on haiku.
Haiku,
yeah.
And it was one that it seemed like everybody could feel good about.
Writing a haiku, it's just a very accessible way of poetry because they're very simple. They don't take a whole lot of time, and they're kind of fun. And they're just a few basic rules. And anybody could write one. And I think anybody could write a good one. And so I think it's a neat way to, you could sit down and in 15 minutes you could write a neat haiku. And it's a very accessible way for people to try their hand at some poetry.
Now, John, when you were writing Beside a Burning Sea, did you start out with characters or plot? And did either of them change as you went along?
Well, the first thing I do is I think about the broad story. What I've kind of got my next couple of books plotted out in my head. I do is think about what part of the world do I want to bring to life? Well, for my third novel, it's going to be modern-day Saigon. for my fourth novel, it's going to be modern-day Thailand. So I kind of have that idea. And then what I do is I kind of populate that idea with characters and think about which characters are going to make this story move. How can they drive it forward? And then I come up with 8 or 9 different characters. And then I go back almost to the plot and think, how do I move this plot forward with these characters and so forth? So it's kind of this back and forth between characters and plot until I really understand where the book is going. And then I'll sit down and do a pretty detailed outline that sketches everything out. And then I just sit down and write. And once I get really into the book, and it almost starts to kind of write itself. It was weird, this third novel that I'm working on now about the Vietnamese street children, it's really written itself, and I'm not sure why that is, but it's exciting and it's fun to have things flowing that well.
I'm sure it is.
So do you know how the story is going to end when you start?
I do. Now, that can change. that can definitely change. Like my first novel, Beneath the Marble Sky, at the end, my narrator escapes this prison. And my first few drafts, I had a different way that she got out of it. And then ultimately I decided that this better way kind of pops into my head, a way that makes a lot more sense and has some kind of meaning behind it. So my books will definitely evolve, and I'll have these great outlines, but then once I really get in neck deep into the book, it can totally go off in a different direction.
No, go ahead.
No, that's okay.
Well, do you have, in Beside a Burning Sea, do you have a character that you most identify with?
Well, there are a couple of characters that I identify with. I mean, certainly I like the Japanese character a lot, and I think he's I'm very connected to him, and there's definitely parts of me inside him. And then the woman he falls in love with, this American nurse, she's my first book. There's a very strong woman in the book, but Jahanara, my narrator, is a very strong woman. She makes some bad decisions, but she's a very strong person, and kind of the heroine of my second novel, Annie. She's not strong like that on the outside, but she also gets stronger as the book goes on.
Mm-hmm.
It makes this kind of evolution of her character, and I kind of like that. I mean, I like to think that people can change like that, and so I identified with that transition. And then for my third novel, it's interesting about the two Americans and the Vietnamese street kids. Right now, and I've still got 3 months to go to finish this, but right now I like my Vietnamese characters better than my American characters, and I think my Vietnamese characters are more original and unique characters. So I'm aware of the fact that I need to kind of elevate my two Americans, and I'll definitely do that. But it's interesting how the Vietnamese characters were easier to write for some bizarre reason than the two Americans. So I'm never quite sure how that's going to evolve.
So, John, in these books, because of the setting and the time place, particularly in your first two books where it's not modern time, you have to do a lot of research. Do you do all the research first and then begin writing, or are you writing and researching kind of intermingled as you go along?
I really feel most comfortable if I do all the research first, because the worst thing can happen to me is to start the book and get into it and then realize I've made a mistake from a historical perspective, or I've totally forgotten something. I mean, that's just a disaster. So I'd rather do all the research up front, really understand the period that I'm trying to bring to life, and then start writing.
Well, I can see how that would, because you have to have a form in mind. You have to have the whole picture in mind before you start.
Yeah, you can't write about something that you don't understand. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, some people do, but
so I for me, it's just so important to get to know. And that's why I always travel to places that I write about. I mean, my new novel that I'm working on now is set in modern-day Saigon. I've been there 3 times. So a lot of that is really trying to get a sense of time and place and what it's like over there.
Do you have a title for that book?
What's that?
What is the title for that book?
Oh, that's going to be called In the Footsteps of Dragons.
Ooh, and, your titles are very intriguing, too.
Thanks.
You know?
I kind of like to do do things that are a little different.
Yeah.
And they all have meaning once you get there. And for instance, in the footsteps of dragons, dragons in Vietnam are like in the West, dragons are feared. They're kind of vilified. Mm-hmm. But in the East, dragons are revered, and they're seen as protectors and so forth. And so in the footsteps of dragons, it's really, the dragons are the children in that book. And so it's really the story of these two Americans almost following these children. And so I do like to come up with kind of different titles, and that's fun for me.
And how do you decide on which title's right?
Well, typically what I'll do is I'll have an idea for a title, and I'll send it to my editor. And they don't always agree with me. And if they don't agree with me, they say, like the original title for Beside a Burning Sea, it was going to be called The Poet Maker. And they liked it, but they said it just didn't have enough of an edge. So I came up with Beside a Burning Sea, which they really liked. So they definitely have input, and they'll try to steer me in a direction, but it's ultimately me who comes up with the title.
Now, John, as you're writing, do you do, like some writers will do a first draft very quickly without really stopping, and then go back and do a complete edit and then another complete edit? Or and what's your process like?
Well, now that I have a year deadline per book, what I do is I'll spend about 6 months writing the first draft and then about 6 months editing. And 6 months editing gives me time to read through the book and rewrite it and revise it about 20 times. So it's pretty tight.
Wow.
And more edits than most writers do. But it's important. I mean, every time I read the book, it gets a little bit better. I improve the dialogue a bit. I add dimensions to the characters a bit. I improve the prose a bit. So every time I can do an edit, the book gets a little bit better. So those 20 edits are really important to me. And I want to give myself enough time to do that right.
How do you know when you're done?
It's a good question. I know when I'm done when I'm basically changing nothing. In those final edits,
okay,
I'll be making one little change every five pages. And at that point, I'm just like, you know, there's really, this book is not going to get any better. And I'm content with it. But it's really not until it reached that level where it's extremely clean and I'm just not seeing anything that I want to change.
Now, is it at that point that it goes to your editor?
Yep. So then I'll send it off.
And then what happens?
What's that?
And then what happens?
Well, editors, what she'll do is she'll come back to me and she'll say things like, I don't really like it how this character did this thing. Or would this character really think about this? She'll kind of give me these big picture things. And, you know, she might give me 12 of them, and I might agree with half of them. So then I'll go back and I'll make those 6 changes. She doesn't really do any kind of line editing. Basically, after I make her suggestions, the ones that I agree with, then it'll go to the copy editor at my publishing house, Penguin, and the copy editor will go in and make sure that everything is grammatically correct and so forth. And that's kind of the process of the book.
How did you find your publisher in the first place?
Well, I had to get an agent, and I got a very powerful agent initially for Beneath the Marble Sky, and it didn't quite work out, and I had to get another agent. I mean, it's in fiction, you really have to get an agent, and it's somebody from Iowa, and I didn't have any connections in New York. I think there was a bit of a prejudice against me almost. I think publishers would look at me and agents would look at me and say, now, what's this guy from Iowa all about the Taj Mahal before?
Mm.
And I was very aware of that, and it always kind of annoyed me because I felt like I'd written a really beautiful book. And I finally got some people who were really on board and believed in it. And that was not easy to do, but I found them. And they've been proven to be right. I mean, the book has done phenomenally well. And all these people who a couple of years ago told me to go write something else, now I get emails from them congratulating me. So just confess, that's been kind of nice.
Yeah. So when you set out to look for an agent, had you already had the book finished at that point? And so did you go through, you know, Writer's Market and pick out names and just start sending, or what did you do to find your agent?
You have to query an agent, and I didn't know anybody, so it was essentially I would write many letters and send these letters off to different agents talking about my project and what I had done, and be hoping that these agents would be interested in taking a look at my work. And I definitely had some writing back saying, please send me your manuscript. And I've never had a problem finding an agent. My problem has always been the agent following through on what they have agreed to, actually selling the book.
Mm.
And I finally got a great agent now, and she's very powerful, and she's really in tune with what I want to do, and I'm one of her top authors, so she pays me a lot of attention, and we've got a great relationship. But that's taken me probably 5 years to have, find that relationship.
Well, from the time you finished writing your first book until you actually sold it, what was the timeline for that?
Oh, probably about a year.
Oh, that's not so bad. I mean, I'm sure it was a very frustrating year for you.
Well, it's frustrating when you know, I had one publishing house that the first editor loved it, and her boss loved it, and his boss loved it, and her boss, you know, and it just went up all the way to the top. I got all the way to the publisher, and the publisher wrote my agent and said, "This is a great book. I love Beneath the Marble Sky. Beautiful story. Well written, but I'm not going to do a work of historical fiction about the Taj Mahal because we just published Cleopatra, a story about Cleopatra, and it didn't sell."
Oh.
My agent, you know, I mean, the story of Cleopatra has been done 20 times.
Absolutely.
Has ever done a novel on the Taj Mahal? What does one have to do with the other? So things like that would happen that would really frustrate me to extremely, you know, extremely so. But I kept with it and I didn't give up. And because I believed in the book.
And now you have a good relationship with your agent and with your publisher.
And I do.
So you don't have to worry about that part of it anymore.
Exactly. I don't worry about that part. And you know, Penguin has been great at promoting my new book, Beside a Burning Sea. It's in every bookstore in the country. It's in airport bookstores. It's everywhere. So it's fun to be in all these random stores and see big piles of my book.
I'll bet.
They've done a great job promoting it, and that's been nice to have them on board.
Now, you talked about the cover, which is a beautiful cover. Do you have any input into that, or is that the publisher's?
No, I do. The cover was actually my idea. I thought it'd be neat to be looking out from this beautiful island, perhaps from among some flowers, and to see this distant warship kind of looming in the distance. And they kind of ran with that idea, and whoever designed it did a marvelous job, because I think it's really beautiful.
It is.
Now, the blurb on the front says, "A master storyteller, Beside a Burning Sea confirms again that Shores is an immense talent," and that is from Amy Tan. How did you get her to write this for your book?
Well, it's funny. It's really on the responsibility of the author to get those blurbs. And it's not easy being a first-time novelist and basically knowing nobody. But I was lucky enough that my book has done very, very well in France. We sold a lot of copies in France. And so my French publisher invited my wife and I out to a big literary festival in France with top writers from all over the world. It's one of the kind of classic literary festivals in the world, and very, very well attended. And my French publisher had two American authors, and it was myself and Amy Tan. So over a three-day period, I got to know Amy well.
Oh.
She was great. We had a lot of wonderful conversations, and I asked her if she'd be kind enough to read my book, and if she didn't like it, I didn't want a blurb, but if she liked it,
of course.
If she could give me a blurb. And she was very sweet and generous, and she gave me that nice testimonial.
Well, every author's been in that position at one time of starting out and needing that support from the ones who've gone before.
Absolutely.
So I expect your turn will be coming pretty soon.
My turn's already I just read a manuscript about a week ago, and my publisher's now starting to, or various other writers are sending me manuscripts to read, and it's funny, I'm getting more requests right now than I can possibly do, so I have to figure out which books I want to read, which books make sense, which books are the closest to mine so that my readers might be influenced with what I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want my readers to be led astray. I don't want to comment on a book totally outside of my genre. I don't feel like that's ethically right to do. So I'm kind of picky about what I'm blurbing, but I'm starting to do it more and more, and it's kind of fun. I enjoy it.
Oh, that's cool. Let's see. What is the most interesting question you've ever been asked at by a book group or at a book reading?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I get asked so many. I've spoken to 1,300 book clubs, so I've fielded thousands and thousands of questions, and they're all so different and unique and compelling. And I'm very surprised sometimes at how insightful readers are, and they interpret the book differently than I do. And sometimes they see things differently, and I'm really interested in these interpretations. And we have wonderful conversations about the different perspectives and so forth. So, and I often hear new perspectives and things that I haven't heard before, and that's really gratifying to me as a writer.
You know, when I was a kid in school, and Caroline was an English teacher, so she was on the other side of this, I remember, you know, we'd read a piece and be analyzing what did the author mean by this, and, you know, what was, and sometimes you'd go into, you know, well, there's whole articles written about the meaning of a single paragraph of some famous book or something. And I started to wonder after a while if the author really meant anything beyond...
Exactly right. And I think that sometimes critics and people who are writing these essays, they read too much stuff into this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would have arguments in college with my professors who would be looking at there was one, it's funny, I remember arguing with a professor, and it was a piece Hemingway had written, and I don't remember what the novel was, but it was about this guy fly fishing, and it was this beautiful scene. This guy was fly fishing, he had his fishing rod, and the professor said, you know what this is all about? It's about something a man would do with himself. And no, I disagree. I think it's about this guy fly fishing. Are we reading all this into this?
Yeah, I think that's
I would have these, you know, arguments with teachers almost 20 years ago, and I think you're right, and that does get things sometimes get interpreted differently as the author writes. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, readers interpret a book differently, and there's no right or wrong to it. But I think that you're right in that sometimes readers are perhaps looking a little too closely for stuff like that the writer really doesn't plan on putting in there.
But maybe that's the mark of a truly talented writer, is that you allow the reader to read things into it that you...
Yeah, and I think all that stuff's great, and I love it when readers will say things to me like that, like, was this scene or was this image symbolic of XYZ? And I'll be thinking to myself, no, that's not my intent, but I can see how you can interpret it that way. It's really neat that you took the time to interpret it that way and to talk about it, and let's talk about it some more. And so I'm certainly very welcoming of all those conversations, and it's fascinating to me as a writer to see how people interpret those different things.
The problem, as I see it from a teacher standpoint, is I think it sometimes turns the average student off to literature. Because
type of criticism,
trying to
analyze
symbolism and everything, just read it, enjoy, you know.
I think that's a great point too.
Yeah,
and I think you're completely right in that sometimes being too interested in figuring out these little mysteries inside a book can turn the average reader off, and I think there's a little bit of, like in any industry, there's a bit of a, I don't know if a snob appeal is the right thing, but I think it definitely exists in the publishing industry.
Oh,
for instance, my second novel, Beside a Burning Sea, went straight to trade paperback, and the reason for that is because of the economy. My publisher thought that a lot of people wouldn't want to spend $25 on a hardcover, so they said, let's go straight to trade paperback, John. That way you can get all the big bookstores right away, can be in Target and Costco, and have people have access to your book. And there's truth to that, and it's great. The problem is that most reviewers want to review a hardcover.
Wow.
So my book didn't get as reviewed as much as it would have if it had been a hardcover. And that kind of frustrated me, in that I'm thinking, gosh, don't we want people out reading? And, you know, why in this economy do these snobby reviewers think that a book has to be a hardcover to be reviewed? And, my first print run was 100,000 copies, which is a nice print run, and it's a book and I think that that's a problem in the publishing industry, and I hope that it goes away.
Well, John, we're about out of time, but I wanted to make one comment. You know, we talked about Beside a Burning Sea as being a love story set in the South Pacific, but it's also a suspense novel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
There's a villain, and he's quite villainous. How is it for you writing from the villain's perspective?
You know, I must say I kind of enjoy it. just because I like, as I mentioned earlier, I like to create a different voice and a unique voice, and to try to bring those to life. And certainly having this very evil person in my book is a different sort of a voice. And it's a change of pace for me as a writer to go from having this perhaps a romantic setting between the Japanese soldier and the American nurse to this American traitor who's this awful guy. And it was kind of a nice change of pace. Keeps me fresh as a writer, and I enjoy that.
Well, all of your characters had a tremendous voice, I think, in this. I mean, I could identify with all of them. I could see them.
Good.
That, you know, and I really enjoyed it.
And we're looking forward to the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, John. And please get in touch when your next book comes out.
I will, and thank you so much for your support, and my best wishes to all of your listeners.
Thank you. Sure. That was John Shores, author of Beside a Burning Sea. And now, please stay tuned for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore and his always wonderful eclectic romp through the worlds of music and politics and literature and just about everything else. He'll be interviewing Naomi Wolf at 4 o'clock this afternoon, so we're looking forward to that. And we will now close with a quote from Mom.
Okay, well, I think this kind of goes to what our guest said. It's good to be humble enough to receive correction, yet confident enough not to let the opinion of others control us.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.